Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, a media observer, a media critic, and a media participant as well, helping everyone connect the dots between all of the different facets of what interconnects our world to create healthy people, healthy communities, a healthy society, and a healthy planet. And obviously, you know, we're kind of skewing off course on a number of those counts. And each week on the show, I talk with different activists, authors, scientists, doctors, filmmakers, documentarians, even musicians, all kinds of people about the different facets of all that interconnects in our world to bring us to health or push us toward ill health, breakdown, and planetary destabilization, which is a big concern that we cover regularly on this program. This week, I am delighted to have joining us as the guest of the week someone with whom I've had the pleasure to work in the opposition to the international globalist trade agenda, and way beyond. So, you know, we've met in the trenches, and Lawrence Steiner, our guest today, is someone I highly, highly respect, love as a friend, respect as an activist, and is a real force for good in these challenging times through her superb work with her own weekly show on YouTube called The Robust Opposition. She has a wonderful history. She led LA for Bernie for over a year and was a delegate, a Sanders delegate at the Democratic National Convention. She's now helping former Bernie Sanders delegates take over the Democratic Party in California. Yay! And she is reigniting her early career in broadcast journalism by live streaming activist events and hosting, again, her wonderful weekly show, The Robust Opposition. I had the honor to be a guest on that about a week or so ago. You can Google that, search it out on YouTube, and it's not only terrific interviews that Lauren does with so many of the people that we want to hear more from, but also she literally produces events coverage, documentaries, and really keeps all who follow her and admire her work just really up to date on the many ways that civil participation is breaking out all over. So happy to have you here this week. Lauren, welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction. I'm really happy to be on your show, Allison.
Thank you, Lauren. So, you know, basically, I also have to confess to you, probably may have noticed this, but to my listeners, you know, Facebook now has this thing where you can only, like, first follow 10 people, right, for people who are into social media. And, you know, what you see and what you're informed about really will depend upon your pick. I mean, you can shape your own understanding of the world, your own news environment, your own world for friendship by, you know, who you follow more closely. And Lauren is definitely in my top 10 of who I follow first, because she's one of the most well-informed and astute commentators on a lot of stuff that's going out there. And I have long wanted to have Lauren on the show. This past week, something came up that was just so egregious that she brought to attention for a number of us that I thought it was not only something that you listeners would want to know about, but that really everyone who's now kind of getting either more deeply involved or getting involved for the first time really needs to know about. And that is, you know, what is grassroots activism? How do we recognize the real thing? How do we make decisions in an environment where there are so many fronts that it seems that we have to be fighting on simultaneously, and so many groups representing various things suddenly, you know, coming out of the woodwork? Some of them, like, you know, the Sanders people have been working together for some time. There are other longstanding groups, but there are a lot of people that are now suddenly adopting or trying to adopt or co-opt, might be a better word, grassroots activism as a brand. And Lauren, you drew attention to an instance of this past week as we kind of begin to talk about that and give people an idea of how we need to be more discerning in who we follow and what we get involved with.
You want me to discuss that?
Yeah, like, well, yeah, I'd like you to talk about, like, the Maddow incident, and then we can go on from there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, I received a private message on Facebook from two separate people, and it was one of those copy-paste things, and it said, do not share, send by private message, and it was basically about how Rachel Maddow and Stephen Colbert were starting this effort called hashtag Fire the Fool. And it was going to be this big event protest on April 1st, which is April Fool's Day. And what they were saying was, we want to create some buzz around this hashtag before the launch. And it seemed to me such a common way that these AstroTurf groups operate. And the term AstroTurf is in contrast to the term grassroots, because as everybody knows, AstroTurf is synthetic grass. So somebody, not me, came up with the term, and I've been using it for years. But so far, it's really been to describe right-wing groups, such as the Koch brothers. They have a group called Americans for Prosperity. And that is a group that is fully funded by those billionaire brothers. They were behind the Tea Party town hall protests in the summer of 2009 when Obama was trying to introduce Obamacare, and they bust in, supposed normal people to these Democratic legislators' town hall meetings that they were having in the summer to rail against Obamacare and socialized medicine. I'll never forget one sign I saw at one of those. It says, get government, was spelled like G-U-V-M-I-N-T, out of my health care. Get government out of my Medicare, completely misunderstanding the fact that Medicare is a government-run program. Similarly,
right.
You've probably heard stories about how Republicans or people who voted for Trump, they don't necessarily have to be Republicans, were basically, they did not know that there was a difference between the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. So they're railing against Obamacare and saying it's a great thing that it's going to be repealed. And then they're asked by the interviewer, what's going to happen to your health care? And they said, don't worry, I have the Affordable Care Act. So it's just amazing to me the ignorance of people, and that basically leaves them susceptible to be influenced by AstroTurf groups. So I basically posted that Rachel Maddow, to me, she calls herself a liberal, by the way. She never uses the word progressive, and I find that interesting because I think there is a difference between liberals and progressives. And liberals, to me, are the people that were completely irate during George Bush's administration, including Rachel Maddow and many of my friends, but then they seemingly fell asleep during the 8 years of the Obama administration when he did all the horrible things he did. And for people like that, it just seems to matter whether the person is a Democrat or Republican, or whether the person seems intelligent, like Obama seems very intelligent and thoughtful and is well-spoken. And when it was his last day, a lot of people were talking about how they're going to miss him and what a lovely man and a good husband and a father. And it was all style over substance. Similarly, people are posting today about the Muslim ban in these seven countries, and others of us who are critical thinkers are questioning, where were you when Obama was drone striking those very same seven countries? Where was your concern for all the Muslims that were being killed by Obama's illegal drone wars?
Let me just interject something here, Lauren. Breaking form, because it's not something I often do, but I watched the Super Bowl this past week. Actually, it was an amazing game. Let's hope it wasn't entirely staged, but I mean, it was just brilliantly breathtaking. You were on the edge of the seat the whole time. But one of the things I noticed about the game is that the New England Patriots are there there in their blue, and the Atlanta Falcons are there in their red outfits, and it's just like, you know, a big sporting event, and it's kind of like, who will win, the blue versus the red? And it's just like a big game. And when, you know, one thinks of degenerating civilizations, falling civilizations historically, has, you know, different historians and scholars have detailed, one thinks of, you know, bread and circuses in Rome, and you know, here are these huge spectacles, and you know, what people can really focus on is, you know, this, that's my color and I root for them. I don't really have to look closely in any great detail at what they're doing. I don't, you know, have to be well informed about it. And so there's this, you know, this, and part of it is mass media, just this very broad stroke thing, you know, I'm for the blue, that's my team. And then, as you point out, everybody is like, if the Blues are in, I'm good, we won, you know, whatever that means, and it's over.
Yeah, well, that's I totally agree with you, and I use the term bread and circuses very often, because that is how they distract us. And Edward Bernays, who is the inventor of public relations, basically taught everybody how to do that. So, you know, Chris Hedges, who is my favorite public intellectual writing today, mm-hmm. has a book called Death of the Liberal Class. And mm-hmm. he uses that word liberal intentionally as well. And he talks about how all the liberal institutions that used to look out for the working class have been co-opted. And he specifically lists journalism and the media, the Democratic Party, labor unions, the university, the clergy. I mean, I guess it was about last year I became aware that the Koch brothers were actually buying entire economics departments of major universities, because these universities are starved for funds, because mm-hmm. the government is defunding, of course, any public good or public service that we need. And so they are looking to corporations, and the Koch brothers have a very specific free market philosophy, the Austrian school, the Friedrich Hayek school of economics, and they are placing professors into these economics departments. The guy who started the campaign against this is a Facebook friend of mine, and he was doing his postgraduate work at Florida State University, where the Koch brothers have bought up the entire economics department. And this all goes back to the Powell memo of mm-hmm. 1970 or 71. My friend Donald Goldmacher did an excellent documentary. I think you can find it on YouTube for free, or maybe you pay $2.99 at Amazon. I'm not sure, but it's called Heist, H-E-I-S-T. And he talks about the Powell memo. This was Lewis Powell, who before he was a Supreme Court justice was an attorney, I think for the Chamber of Commerce, or at least he wrote the memo for the Chamber of Commerce. And it was in 71, I believe, when you remember the 60s movement was in full swing, and the business community was concerned about their waning influence over politics. We all love to talk about how Richard Nixon would now be considered a liberal because he, you know, he established the EPA and all these other agencies. Well, he did that because the mood of the country was very liberal back then. So the Powell memo talked about how businesses had to start lobbying more. This is before K Street became the force that it is, how they needed to take over the universities, how they needed to start think tanks. And now we see the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institution and the Hoover Institute. And they needed to have their own media, which is Fox News. So basically, mm-hmm. this documentary Heist is organized structurally into each one of these things in the memo and shows how this unfurled. And I organized a two-day teach-in at Occupy LA in November of 2011, and our closing film was Heist. And this was before it was still like a rough cut, and he actually edited the Occupy movement into the final version. And I thought that year that it was actually a better film, well, not necessarily better in terms of the way it was produced, But in terms of what it covered, I thought it was a better film than even Inside Job by Charles Ferguson, which was wonderful. But that film just kind of traced the financial collapse of 2008. And Heist traced what's happened in our country basically over the last 35 years. So Chris Hedges calls this out. And Rachel Maddow, you know, I used to like her because I thought that she did some very good investigative reporting, and I kind of liked her style. It's breezy and fun, and, you know, but this past year I grew to hate her because of the way that she was subtly shilling for Hillary Clinton and being disdainful of Bernie Sanders. And the way that she covered him was always like the negative things that happened in his campaign. I'll never forget when the campaign manager in California resigned, and she made that like the top of her news, like, ooh, there's trouble in Bernie Sanders' campaign, to just highlight that as a controversy, which certainly did not need elevation to a nightly network news show. It simply was there was a difference in direction. I actually agreed with the guy who resigned because he wanted to go put more emphasis on field operations and the ground game than on television, because they just didn't have enough money by the time they got into California to do a big enough television buy. And in reality, as Bernie himself pointed out when he addressed us at the Los Angeles headquarters 2 days before the primary, the majority of his voters, or I should say the majority of people under 45 in every demographic, every ethnic demographic, gender demographic, were people under 45, and they basically had cut the cord. You know, they get their information through social media. So television was a huge waste of money. And when he, you know, he did, Tad Devine did run wonderful ads, like the America ad was definitely one of the best ads, political ads I'd ever seen on television. But, you know, as I used to say during the campaign, Bernie is not running for a Clio award. You know, the Clios are the advertising.
Yeah.
He's running to be president of the United States. So let's put our resources, which were amazing that he was able to get over $250 million from, you know, an average donations of $27. Let's put those resources, you know, into the ground game. He had 100 field representatives, field organizers in tiny New Hampshire. But by the time he came out to California, he only had 50 in the largest state in the country with the most delegates to be won. He fired, I think he fired 290 people after the New York loss. And Tad Devine was bragging in Politico how they were going into Indiana, and because Hillary Clinton wasn't going to buy a single ad, they were going to cut their ad buy from $1.2 million to $1 million. And I was thinking to myself when I read this, he could take that $1 million would buy back, you know, because they were paying field organizers $27.50 a month. He could buy back those field organizers. He could buy back all 290 of them for 5 weeks and put them in the remaining states. And possibly could have, you know, won California and thus won the nomination. So I have a little bit of a book in me, or at least an article, about the problems with the Bernie Sanders campaign, as much as I love Bernie and his platform. But, I mean, I don't know how I got diverted off of that.
Well, so we were talking about the fact that Rachel Maddow is, you know, trying to sort of brand an effort of her own, this April Fool's effort, as being a grassroots effort, and your statement that, you know, you're contextualizing that someone can be a liberal, but they can be an establishment mainstream liberal with a very different agenda than the kinds of agendas that are emerging from the grassroots. So I think that's, you know, and then you backed it up to show the history of our kind of you know, the hijacking of the liberal establishment, you know, through academia, the media, science, I would also argue, by this concerted effort to move the country right. And hence what we identify as being liberal is far to the right of Richard Nixon. And so, and here we have Rachel Maddow, who you use as an example of, you know, her negative coverage of Bernie Sanders, her not giving him a fair shake, her picking at the campaign for making what was probably a good move that should have been made earlier, in your estimation, is one close to the Sanders campaign. But, you know, frankly, that anyone that has a celebrity reach, you know, that Maddow does, that Colbert does, is then trying to, you know, put on the hair shirt of activism and claim that it's like the newest celebrity fashion garment, is an affront to everyone who's a true activist, you know.
Let me speak to the Women's March about that, because I have some feelings about that, having gone down to Washington to cover both Occupy inauguration protests on the inauguration day and then the Women's March the next day. But just one more point about Rachel Maddow before I do that. The most dangerous thing that Rachel Maddow is doing right now, by the way, is Russia, Russia, Russia. And I think we spoke about this because this is the entire liberal establishment that cannot accept the fact. They cannot accept the fact and take responsibility for the fact that they backed the absolute worst candidate to run against Donald Trump. We tried to tell them in Philadelphia, and I know you want to talk about this later, but the delegates went to Philadelphia with our map, our blown-up map from Real Clear Politics, which showed if Hillary was the nominee and Trump was the nominee, how many states Trump would beat her by. And the real map was actually way worse. He won many more states. So we knew, because of all the polling done then, that Bernie had a much better chance of beating Trump than Hillary did, but nobody wanted to talk about that. They were completely dismissive, and they were just pushing Hillary, 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 and the campaign ran the absolute wrong kind of campaign. They ran it on identity politics and fear of Trump, when in fact it was an anti-establishment populist year that Bernie Sanders got and Donald Trump, to his credit, got, but he exploited it. He's not really an anti-establishment, as we can see by the billionaires he's put into his cabinet, and he's certainly not a populist, because what his policies will do will only increase the income inequality between the top 1%, or in his case, probably the top 0.001%, and everybody else. So Rachel Maddow and the rest of the liberal media are basically trying to blame everything they can and everyone they can for Hillary's loss, including the FBI and James Comey's announcement, including
Assange, WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks, the DNC leaks, and finally Russia, basically saying that Russia hacked the election with absolutely no proof, and they're citing these 17 intelligence agencies, and they're talking about, it was either the estimate or the analysis, and I read a really interesting article that said there's a big difference between an estimate and analysis, and one is for sure, and the other is just a guess. And they're hopping onto this guess, and they're getting in bed with some of the worst actors in American foreign policy, and I'm speaking specifically of the CIA, which has interfered, ironically. You know, they're calling out the Russians, but the CIA has interfered in 82 different elections since it was established and has fomented at least, 3 coup d'etats. So it's kind of the pot calling the kettle black, and without any proof whatsoever, and it's completely designed to deflect from their own complicity in this horrific election result. And, the other people they're blaming it on is the Bernie Sanders supporters, who they're insisting stayed home, or voted for Trump, or voted for Jill Stein, which is a joke.
Well, you know, it's like, for all we know, and I would regard it as very likely, part of the numbers that Hillary Clinton got were very likely from Sanders supporters, people who were holding their nose. There were many, 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 many people who bought into that argument, didn't see another option, and did that. And yet, the minute they do that, instead of recognizing that you have a bifurcated liberal spectrum that includes progressives who have played a very activated role in the last year and continue to do so, instead of acknowledging who the people really are, there's instant co-option. Everybody who voted for Hillary trying to prevent a Trump presidency is suddenly a Clinton person, you know, dyed in the wool for life and holding the same points of view. These are the last people that, I mean, you know, the activists I know, they many of them work jobs and then do activism on top of it. Some people live very simply. They're young. They live with other people. There's hardship involved. It's not something that you just put on and pretend that you're leading the parade from the insulated place at the top.
The Women's March, that reminds me, I wanted to segue into the Women's March. So I was there, for Inauguration Day. I got nowhere near his actual inauguration because I was too fascinated by what was going on the streets, and started out my morning at the Occupy inauguration rally that was organized by Evan Duke and Ed Higgins and Araquel Bloss and people for several months. And they had various speakers. It started to rain. I saw Tim Canova there, so I kind of veered from the speakers and ended up getting a great interview with Tim Canova. And then we marched, to join. There was another demonstration called J20 and the Trade Justice Coalition, which was Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, who are two activist friends of mine that I've worked with for many years fighting for net neutrality and fighting against the TPP. Those were our two biggest projects that we worked on together. And
yeah,
they
they've been on the show like numerous, numerous times, both Kevin and Margaret together and separately. They're in the show archives because throughout the TPP battle, they really have played a very significant role. And, of course, we've covered that, obsessively.
Yes, and you might want to check out, your listeners may want to check out their organization called PopularResistance.org, which the newsletter, that came out this week talks about how it has to be more than just about Trump and these problems are systemic. But anyway, so then we met, we went to join their march, and on the way I saw a guy with dreadlocks basically diverting people to stay on the street that we were on and not go off on this other street. And so I asked him, well, what's up there? And he says, well, it's the anarchists, and they're getting in trouble, and they've been pulling people off of our march all day. And I said, well, who are they? And he was telling me it's this group Antifa, which is this worldwide anti-fascist organization. And I said, well, am I likely to be taking a risk if I go up there? And he says, well, you are, especially if you don't have a press pass. And so I'm like, okay. And I'm like, that's where I'm going, folks. And so I veered off the march, and I found myself right in the middle of all the action. And I have to tell you, Allison, it was one of the most exciting moments of my life, because there I was with my little iPhone 7 documenting this melee between, the cops on one side and the black bloc anarchists on the other. And at one point, I was standing right in the middle of it, and a rock went over my head one way, and a tear gas canister went over my head the other way. And it was like, I felt like this is what I meant to do, And but for the rest of the day, I was just asking people, who these people were, because I was trying to determine if they were infiltrators, COINTELPRO. Some of your younger listeners probably don't know about COINTELPRO unless they're, studied history. But this was a group that was organized, by the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover to infiltrate protest movements such as the Black Panthers to make them look bad. And we know for a fact that in Occupy Oakland, the day that Scott Olson had his head bashed in, that the people who were throwing bricks into windows up there were the black bloc anarchists, were not occupiers. They were infiltrators trying to make the Occupy movement look bad. And it played right into, the mainstream narrative, because, they had a conference call with 28 Democratic mayors, by the way, three of whom I know started out as community organizers, the mayors of Los Angeles, Seattle, and Portland, or Oakland, I'm sorry. And 3 weeks later, the Occupy encampments were cleared, and they used the same excuses. There was drug use, there was crime, it was unhealthy, unsanitary conditions, and these were how these mayors were instructed to clear these camps, because they could see that the occupiers were like planning to move in for good. I mean, I remember I was part of the movement. I didn't live down there. I was raising two, you know, school age kids at the time. But I remember one day going down there where my friend Tomas O'Grady, whose organization puts vegetable boxes into middle schools, he was donating some of his vegetable boxes to Occupy LA so they could grow their own fruits and vegetables. And no sooner did he, you know, unload them off the truck than the health department was there to tell them, no, those are not getting installed here, because they were, you know, seeing that, oh, my God, we were going to make a community here. And that was the most fearful thing. So, you know, in retrospect, people talked about Occupy and the tactics and how maybe it should have been less permanent and more mobile. You know, I don't really want to get into that whole discussion right now, but the fact of the matter is that in D.C., most of the people that I interviewed that were wearing black seemed to me to just be like normal kids. And I would ask people to check out my own personal YouTube channel, or you could check out ourrevolution.tv, because that's where, in the last show that we did, not yesterday, but a week ago Sunday, I edited a 30-minute compilation tape, and I did an excellent interview with an activist from Oakland who said, you know, I object to that term infiltrator. I mean, these are just kids that have nothing, you know, except a rock in their hand. And, you know, they're just so desperate. And what is the alternative that the liberals are offering them? And that is to call their congressman. And the way she said it was so eloquent. I can't even do justice to the way that she articulated this. But after you heard her impassioned, you know, interview with me, you would want to be out on the streets with that rock in your hand as well. Because basically,
Let me just interject here, Lauren, that for those listening who may not be aware of this, in the aftermath of the Women's March, there was an action page that people could go to, and what Lauren's referring to here is that they were basically saying, you know, write a postcard and say hi to your congressman and your senator, let them know your concerns and this kind of thing. When it comes to any kind of successful action or organizing, this would be extremely tepid, almost placeholder advice. You know, the people who are deeply concerned about specific issues, and, you know, there's no targeting of issues there. There's no real pressure in get used to writing a postcard or something like that. And I just want to contextualize that that's what you're referring to, Lauren, for our listeners.
Yes, it was another one of my snarky Facebook posts. I got invited by a friend of mine who I met at a No Dapple protest, and she's very concerned about that issue. And she sent me a private message saying that she was having people over on Tuesday to write postcards. And I think, in defense of that action, I think these postcards were very specifically directed against Trump's nominees. They were asking Democrats to not vote for Trump's nominees. But I put a post on my Facebook page that said, "Watch out, Trump, the postcards are coming," you know? Like, that's
right.
That's not going to cut it. But then other people kind of commented, and this is what I do like about Facebook, because, you know, one of the problems is, you know, we're preaching to our own choirs, and with the algorithms, you know, one thing they
right.
do is they only send, you know, to 2% of your Facebook friends, so that's kind of upsetting. But there is, even within the choir, there is some dissension, and the
definitely
thing that a Facebook post allows is that this dissension and pushback can kind of, and if you're open-minded like I try to be, you know, it can kind of make you change your mind, because in that particular instance, people were saying to me, well, look, at least it's getting people off of their computers and into a room together where they can, you know, make the kind of connections, personal connections and camaraderie that I do know that on the ground activists need to have. That was one of the things in the Bernie Sanders campaign. I disagreed with the campaign strategy that they thought they were just going to be able to have a map and an events calendar where anybody could start an event and put it up on a map, and they would send you an email to the people within the vicinity of that action, and people would just show up. And that does not replace on-the-ground organizing where people develop relations and do things out of solidarity to their comrades. It's kind of like in the Army. Sometimes when you're in a war zone and you're helping, what they count on to make it all work is that you and your fellow soldiers are part of this team, and you're out there helping them more than, excuse me, I got to get some water. Why don't you comment on what I said while I get some water? But the point is the solidarity towards your fellow activists. I'm going to get some water. Hold on.
Well, you know, the solidarity piece is, you know, it's like on the one hand we have to deepen solidarity, and on the other hand, I think there are people newly coming into activism or really finally, you know, stepping up and, you know, because they're so outraged, and many people who maybe haven't really been undertaking activism either. And, you know, so I also feel like these kinds of conversations and debates that people have are really essential to get more people working together and on the same page, as well as building relationships, like who you trust, who you've worked with before, not in a cliquish sense, but who you can call on when, you know, there's something really going on that's major that needs to be addressed. But, I mean, I have a very diverse following as well, and there are probably people who once followed me who, when the whole split with Sanders and Clinton happened, ceased following me. Some of them may be back following me again. I have people who read the information that showed that people who were peacefully protesting were rioting and burning private property, you know, and becoming incensed and inflamed about that. So I think also it's good to speak beyond the choir and to the choir because there's so much misinformation out there. And I think that people genuinely don't know which, you know, who the bona fide people are, what the good initiatives are, and how to tell what they are. Like, how would a newcomer, I get asked all the time, who do you read, who do you follow? How would a newcomer know that, you know, the job isn't done when we just sign on for a postcard? If somebody reads mainstream media and they're not part of the choir and they're just getting involved, like, how, you know, what would be some signposts that you would offer or suggest for people to make sure that they don't spin their wheels protesting everything that comes down the pike, but really focus on the things that are absolutely crucial to get back, you know, to put our civic policies and decisions back into the hands of the people? Like, what can people who are new to this learn from your experience to do?
Well, first of all, I think it is good to get together locally with your neighbors. And the Women's March, which I feel was really hijacked by celebrities and the Democratic Party. In fact, at the Dakota Access Pipe, the No Dapple, No Keystone XL protest in Los Angeles that I covered yesterday that had like 5,000 people. And I had, so far there's been over 6,700 people who have watched my stream. And standing next to me was the guy from BuzzFeed, and as of last night, 1.7 million had watched it on his stream. So it's amazing how, you know, the alternative media is getting stuff out there. But one of the things that one of the Native American speakers said was that they tried for weeks to get a hold of one of the organizers or to the organizers of the Women's March to have a Native speaker there, and they weren't able to get anywhere because they kept getting bumped by, you know, every new celebrity that wanted to get on there. And I was there, and I got there late. I think the whole thing went for like 4 hours of people essentially talking at you. And I was so far back. I mean, I think that the march was from the starting point to the end point filled with people, so you couldn't even march. They ended up canceling the march part because basically the people at the end of the rally were at the end of the march point. So people kind of marched elsewhere after it, but it was just like people were standing there for 4 hours and a spontaneous chance of let's march erupted because people were tired of listening to speakers. And I've seen that with climate rallies that are organized by NGOs. I call them the nonprofit industrial complex, different organizations, environmental groups. Here in Los Angeles, we've had two of them so far that have gone down exactly the same way. They always do it on a Saturday downtown when there's nobody in downtown Los Angeles because it's only first starting to become somewhat of a residential neighborhood, but it's usually pretty deserted. And it always ends up in front of City Hall, which is a building that's closed on Saturdays. Obviously, there's no local officials working there. And the city council and the mayor have nothing to do with the demands that they were asking for, which is that Jerry Brown should ban fracking. And so they have these climate marches that end up there. And you sit there, both of them, the last two, you sit there for 2 hours listening to speeches. And what they do is they give the organizers an opportunity to crow about the organizational work that they've been doing in their communities. So it's just kind of rewarding activists that work really hard and get no glory, but they get to speak at this climate rally. And yet there's no tables there. There's no organizing going on. And I remember the last one, I was so infuriated because it was the weekend before the deadline to register to vote in California. And I asked if I could have a registration table because I was, you know, running Los Angeles for Bernie and we wanted to get people registered. And they said no, which I shouldn't have listened to them because nonpartisan registration is certainly something that I could do. And when I got there, I saw that the Socialist Party had a registration table and they didn't try to stop them. And also I spoke to Bill McKibben. I got a great interview with Bill McKibben that day and asked him if he would mention, you know, Bernie during his speech because he was a huge supporter. And he said he couldn't do that because, you know, they were all 501c3s that were organizing this and they were concerned about their IRS status. And I found that very ironic because the Koch brothers and all the billionaires, they certainly flout campaign finance laws left and right. They figure out ways to do it. And here are these little nonprofits that are worried that, you know, the IRS is going to have somebody at the climate march noticing that they're mentioning a candidate's name. And even the nurses union, who isn't a 501c3, they actually are a 527, they couldn't even say Bernie Sanders' name. The nurse that spoke said, and you know who our candidate is. And I was tearing out my hair. Because our goal here in California has been to, you know, get a fracking ban. And here's the one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who's calling for a fracking ban in his platform. And they didn't see the utility of having this mention that everybody should. So, you know, basically we had people with banners. We had flyers we were handing out. And that's sort of how we handled it. But I said, you know what, there's a lot of local groups that are trying to shut down that toxic plant or trying to stop the merger of those two refineries or trying to, you know, deny that fracking well permit, whatever. They should all have tables and they should be organizing. So fast forward to something that's coming up in 2 weeks, the general strike, February 17th. People are
calling. Hold on a second.
I just wanted to bring that point up because the guy who's organizing that said to me that that's exactly what he wants to have happen. He wants to have it be like a fair, like a job fair for activists, where everybody has their own tables and people can go up and get involved. So that's a long-winded answer to your question about what people should be looking for. They should be looking for opportunities to plug into local campaigns where they can still have an effect. I personally feel that all this attention on Trump and his cabinet appointees, which you're getting from the nonprofit industrial complex, every single one of them is using the same verbiage, trying to get your money. They want you to sign a petition, which is first and foremost a way to get you on their email list. And then they want you to send them money because help us resist Trump and his horrible appointees. So that it's the same playbook. They put this really scary, you know, verbiage into their emails about how bad Scott Pruitt or Rex Tillerson is. Then they ask you to sign their petition. So they don't even just use one petition, because God forbid there should be one petition that gets 10 million signatures. No, there needs to be 20 different petitions. So it's fragmenting the audience. And and then they want you to send the money, but they never tell you how they're going to do this resistance, you know? And so you have to wonder, where is the money going? Well, it's going to pay their executive salaries and also their organizers. But what are they doing? It's like, you know, what are they doing? So personally, I think that people need to focus. When you don't have a movement like an Occupy movement or a movement candidate like a Bernie Sanders, which kind of encompass multiple issues, then it's really good to try to focus on whatever you're most passionate about, whether it's animal rights or the environment or, you know, media, whatever you're most concerned about, look where the threat is, you know, look who's fighting it, and try to get involved in something where you can actually achieve. Now, we have in California...
Hold on a second before we go to the next topic here. You know, I just want to beg to differ with you slightly, because, you know, you could be concerned. I mean, I think it's great to do local actions. You could be concerned about, you know, pesticide use in your local area or whatever. But aren't there certain overarching leverage points in terms of, you know, the whole idea of writing postcards, for example, to legislative elected officials who are actually beholden to corporations through lobbyists and donors and all the rest of it, is rather nil. Like, I personally think that getting, you know, money out of politics so that that the elected officials actually work for us, rather than in the one case, you know, on the Republican side, boldly they work for corporations. On the Democratic side, you know, subtly with hand signals saying one thing publicly and another thing privately, they do the same thing. So these are overarching issues, and all your smaller issues, and I just use pesticide use in food, and we've done a lot of shows on GMO labeling and everything, and on how we lost the labeling battle. You know, I think we also have to focus on, you know, maybe through local groups, but on some of these national issues, or we won't have an internet, we'll have a completely co-opted government, and we won't have any leverage of any kind at all. So, you know,
well,
I'm playing devil's advocate there.
No, I don't disagree with you. In fact, back in 2007, that was my big issue, getting money out of politics. And when I got involved with the Occupy movement, I had the great pleasure of meeting Dylan Radigan, who was, you know, he started an organization, I think it was called Represent Us, and Josh, forget his last name, ended up being the executive director of that. But I organized a very small dinner party in Santa Monica, and at it were, you know, Dylan Radigan, David DeGraw, who was one of the founders of Occupy Wall Street. He was the one that coined the whole term, the 99% versus the 1%. He was a blogger. Angelique Kronheim, who at the time was working for Common Cause here in Los Angeles, and they were part of a group of NGOs, including Public Citizen and a bunch of other ones based in Washington, that were working on an amendment. And then Mary Beth Fielder, who had started a local chapter of Move to Amend, they had their whole thing. And Cenk Uygar, who started Wolfpack, which was trying to...
What do you think of his upcoming effort?
I'll talk about the convener of Young Turks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll talk about that Justice Democrats thing in a second. But basically, this dinner was one to say, look, we're all trying to get money out of politics, but everybody is working on a different angle. Cenk, you want to do it through the state houses, to have three-fifths of the state houses call for a constitutional amendment. You know, Public Citizen and Common Cause, they're working on this one senator's amendment, and I can't remember who it was. And Move to Amend, you've got a completely different program. And, you know, don't you think that we should all get together on this so that we're all fighting for one thing? And Dylan Radigan said something to me that I'll never forget. And I checked this out because it actually is not a thing. So I think he invented it. He said, well, I believe in the modern theory of insurgency, which is that if everybody is working at one problem but from different angles, it doesn't really matter. It's all good, because at some point, you know, what that serves to do is just generate a lot of attention to the problem, and at some point we will come together on what the specific solution is. So I kind of relaxed. It was my tendency to like micromanage and control and try to take like, okay, here's this movement. And it seems to me, you know, axiomatic that it's best that we try to focus it. And he basically said, no, it's all good. But now here we are, you know, 5 years later, and that movement isn't getting anywhere. And why isn't that movement getting anywhere?
No.
First of all, they even admitted that it would take 10 years to get a constitutional amendment. And I feel, as an environmental activist, the environment being my number one cause, because if we don't have the ability to sustain human life on our planet, then it doesn't matter how what we feel about women's reproductive rights or education, privatization, or any of the other issues that I work on, if we aren't around. So for me, the environment is very pressing. And I, you know, for something that somebody tells me is going to take 10 years, that's not going to be anything that I'm going to direct my attention towards. But meanwhile, the other answer to that question is that the politicians are the ones that have to do this, and they do. They like the system the way it is. Despite what they tell you, they like the system the way it is, both Democrats and Republicans. So that's why I personally don't work on getting money out of politics or campaign finance reform. I think what Bernie Sanders did was better, because he just got money out of politics. He just, in his own quiet way, he was able to demonstrate that you can run a campaign with small dollar contributions, and he just did it. And I feel like he's inspired a lot of people. In California, you know, we just swept 60% of the ADEM elections, the assembly district delegates, because in California, the Democratic Party has delegates just the way they do nationally. And I was unaware of this. I mean, I'm a registered Democrat, and I never knew anything about these elections. You know, apparently it's an insider's game. People come out every 2 years. They vote for their representatives. This year, there were thousands out. In Los Angeles, in the district that I'm in, AD 50, there were about 1,000 people online for 2 hours waiting to vote in this, because of the Bernie Sanders people that decided that they were going to take up Bernie's call to get involved, run for local office. And so we're taking over the Democratic Party. We got 60% of our people elected. And here in California, we don't have Republicans to worry about. We have a supermajority of Democrats. But what we have to worry about is corporate Democrats, like the ones that, you know, voted against Holly Mitchell's bill to ban fracking. So we're talking about, you know, taking over the Democratic Party. We want to get a new chair in there. This guy who's the front runner, Eric Bauman, took money from Big Pharma to oppose Prop 61 that would have lowered the price of prescription drugs for 14% of Californians. This guy's got his hand in all the troughs, the corporate troughs. So we've got a reform candidate that we're pushing. And then we want to organize, you know, Jerry Brown is termed out. In 2018, there's going to be a new governor. We're going to have like a Bernie-crat platform, you know, single-payer health care, ban on fracking, public bank, free college, free public college and university. And if we can't get, you know, there are certain front runners. I happen to like John Chung, who's our state treasurer. If we're going to try to get one of these candidates to endorse this platform so that we can endorse them, and then we plan on running people for elective office in 2018. So that leads to your question about the Justice Democrats. I think the Justice Democrats are fine if you believe that you can take over the Democratic Party and reform it. I think it's possible to do on the state level. I'm not so sure about the federal level. And I look specifically at the race for chairman of the DNC. I mean, you look at Keith Ellison, who started out with so much promise, and every day there's a new story about him on how he's moving towards the center just to get that nomination. Now, I can understand it, because it's not like the general public is voting for that. It's DNC members who are voting for that. So, but he's done things like he's endorsed Steve Battelle, who's this billionaire who in
Hold
Florida.
Hold on a second. We're coming down to about like the last 3 minutes of the show. So,
okay.
You know, we can't go into too much detail on the
okay,
DNC
well,
thing.
Okay.
So.
Well, just basically, I feel that the Justice Democrats is fine, but what it did is it stole some thunder away from Brand New Congress, which was an organization
mm-hmm.
that got started last summer by a former Sanders staffer. And this was supposed to be a postpartisan thing. Like, as long
mm-hmm.
as you endorse Bernie's platform, it didn't matter whether you were a Democrat, a Republican, a Green, or an Independent, you could be part of their slate. So I think what
mm-hmm.
James did is he kind of put this into the Democratic Party, and I don't believe it can be reformed, which is why I'm on the steering committee of Draft Bernie for a People's Party. And we are going to be launching this week, and it's something that, you know, I don't really want to talk about right now because it's before our launch, but, you know, maybe you can have me or Nick Bronya on the show. He's the former Bernie staffer who founded this idea, and you can read about the rationale in the Huffington Post article he wrote, which is called Sanders Can Be the Lincoln of Our Time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how only Bernie, if there's going to be a third party, only Bernie could get something like this off the ground.
Well, that sounds good. that sounds really good, and I can see that that would have a lot of appeal, you know, for a lot of people. And, you know, it's like if you've got the guy, then, you know, you don't need to go designing a separate party. I mean, except for the fact that he himself, you know, has kind of been pledging to work within the Democratic Party, but you know maybe he is really deeply and eternally committed to that. Maybe he isn't. Do you know either way?
Yes, I have my suspicions. In fact, we're putting together a video that is going to include some clips of things that Bernie has said and things that Jane has said, which basically indicate that he's going to give the Democratic Party a short amount of time. But that a third party is not out of the question. And
mm-hmm.
specifically, when Chuck Todd recently asked him if he was going to re-register as a Democrat, because he said, you know, he says, you know, you're out in front for the Democratic Party, and yet you're still not even, you still haven't joined the party. And Bernie answered, well, you know, it's because I was elected as an independent, and I'm going to serve out my term as an independent. And so then he said, well, when you run for re-election, are you going to register as a Democrat? And he said, well, you know, the American people don't really care about what party I'm registered in because I'm going to, you know, keep fighting for the issues. You know how Bernie always deflects those kind of questions about the horse race? So Chuck Todd was visibly flabbergasted. He said, wow. He says, so you're not even committing to run as a Democrat. And I think it was like you could see the shock all over Chuck Todd's face. And to me, that was very telling. And then when
uh-huh.
Jeff Weaver, Bernie's campaign manager, was asked at a Miami-Dade Democratic Party club meeting whether Bernie was going to run in 2020, Jeff Weaver's answer was 79 is the new 50.
I think we're going to close the show on that note. That's a great one, Lauren. That's really excellent. Oh, gosh. Well, that's uplifting and hopeful, isn't it? Well, we'll look
yes.
forward to your upcoming events, and we will have to have you and your cohort on to learn more about that. Thank you so much for joining me and our Connect the Dot listeners today. You're doing great work, lively and wonderful and really in the thick of everything. Congratulations. That's fantastic. So needed, and I look forward to learning more about what you're next proposing. Thank you so much for being with us on today's show.
Great. I just want to say one thing. If your listeners can go to www.ourrevolution.tv, subscribe to our channel, and you will be notified of when our show goes live every week.
Excellent, and it's a terrific show. And check out the edition last week that I was on. It was so much fun and very lively discussion, thought-provoking. Thank you, listeners, for being with us this week on Connect the Dots. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well, chin up, and keep marching forward.
Who, where,